I'd like to continue that discussion for a moment. Field theory started out by the consideration of what happened inside of a box at temperature T. This box contained radiation. They knew that, and they could see it coming out. The question was, how much energy did the box contain? Now, you use formulas like the formulas that existed in statistical physics, and you got 1/2 Boltzmann constant times temperature for as an energy for each degree of freedom in the system. However, radiation has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. It goes down, the field theory of radiation goes down to infinitely short distances. So the lambda you heard about in the last lecture is for radiation effectively infinite. So the total energy they got out of their considerations was infinity times 1/2 kT. This worried people at the end of the 19th century no end, that this was explicitly written about in the works on thermodynamics of J. Willard Gibbs and on statistical mechanics by Ludwig Boltzmann. Eventually, Planck and Einstein fixed things up by, in an ad hoc fashion, inventing the photon to explain how energy came in quantized packets, and this 1/2 kT formula from classical mechanics doesn't work for things of that kind. Back to my main subject. I should mention that the difference between what you saw in the last lecture and what these guys eventually did to describe the physics of photons in a cavity is a very simple difference. Instead of the factor of 3 for the number of polarizations of a phonon, there's a factor of 2 for the number of possible polarizations of a photon. Almost everything else went through exactly as you saw it. Okay, last lecture there was some question about the definition of variance. For definitions, I always look up things in Wikipedia, which is usually pretty good about such things. I did my homework. The variance is indeed defined so that the variance of X is the average difference of X from its average, squared, and averaged. That gives you a reflection of how much fluctuation there is in X. It has the same units as X squared. I'm going to then start out from where I left off last time. Last time I was talking about what happens if you have a single continuous variable phi. You can also talk about what happens if you have a whole bunch of such variables, phi, and a quadratic Hamiltonian, that is a Hamiltonian which is of the form phi I times mij times phi j. That quadratic Hamiltonian is of the form which people worried about, the 1/2 kT, and is the form that applies to electromagnetic radiation, in which the energy is proportional to E squared plus B squared in the appropriate units. In any case, if you've got lots of variables and the energy is proportional to some matrix times phi I times phi j summed over I and j, you can still do the same statistical mechanics as you always did. What you do in principle would occur if you had M as a diagonal matrix. If M were a diagonal matrix, then what you would get is the formula in which there's a sum of terms times phi squared times the diagonal element of m, and each such diagonal element would give you a 2 pi divided by that diagonal element to the 1/2 power. If we have a matrix here, you can imagine diagonalizing the matrix by forming linear combinations of the phi i's, and that you get then get the mij into the form delta ij times mj. That diagonalization then gives you a result in which you have z proportional to the product of 2 pi over the eigenvalues of m to the 1/2 power. Then you recognize this product of eigenvalues as, in fact, exactly what you mean by the determinant of m, so that the proper answer is given here. The partition function z is 2 pi raised to the nth power, or n over 2th power, divided by the determinant of m to the 1/2 power. If any one of these m's is 0 or negative, this formula is nonsense, and the partition function doesn't truly exist. Questions, comments? Okay. I now have a bunch of slides on sort of miscellaneous stuff that's going to come up with respect to these Gaussian random variables. For example, imagine we have a variable eta of t, which is very rapidly varying in time. In the same year as Einstein and Planck were discussing this cavity, Einstein was also working with such a random variable in order to describe the shaking up and back of what is called a Brownian particle. That is a small particle that is sitting in a liquid, and you can see under a microscope shaking up and back. The forces on such a particle occur because of molecular collisions, and the molecular collisions can be described by a random variable, a variable which varies very rapidly in time in a way which is not controllable by the experimenter. The right way of doing it is that you choose the variable so that every time the average of this eta of t is 0, and then you worry about what happens from the summed effect of all of the different times. You imagine that you're looking at the integral over u, eta of u, from the time s to the time t. And then you use what was I described last time as the central limit theorem, the statement that if you have a sum or integral of random variables, if there are lots and lots of them, the result is a Gaussian variable. Here, x of t is Gaussian in its nature and has a variance in the definition that we use of this Gaussian random variable, it has a variance proportional to the magnitude of the difference between s and t. Gamma, then, this coefficient of proportionality defines the strength of the oscillating random variable. We will come back to this point of view in a bit. One more thing we might want to do is calculate an integral like this. I is an integral from A to B, integral dx, exponential of m. M is a big number, times some function of x. If m is really big, that is, in the limit as m goes to infinity, this kind of integral is rather easy to calculate. You have perhaps seen this integrals like this calculated using the idea of steepest descent I will describe what you do using that idea in the simplest case here. Imagine that this that f of x was a real, it's a real function, and that it had a maximum somewhere between a and b. In fact, let's put that maximum at zero, sitting between a and b. Then we could imagine easily that you get a maximum contribution to the integral. In fact, you do for large positive m right near x equals 0. You can expand the integral or integrand around x equals 0 and get a simple result. The zeroth term in the expansion is m times f of 0. You can take that outside the integral. The first order term in the expansion is m times x times f prime of 0. But that term is 0 because we said that 0 is a maximum, and therefore f prime is 0. The next term on is m double prime at 0 times m times x squared over 2. And now we have the integral from a to b of this Gaussian structure. Now, the integral of a Gaussian structure is easy to calculate. We notice that if 0 sits between a and b and m is going to infinity, we get contributions only very near 0, so that a might as well have been minus infinity and b might as well have been plus infinity. So, in fact, let's set it equal to that. Then this is an integral you can look up in a book. The value of the integrand is, the integral is 2 pi over m times f double prime of 0 with a minus sign. This quantity is positive because we assume that f reached a maximum, and here's the answer. In a bit, we will have an integral to do, which is of the form dx cosine x to the m times e to the ikx, where m is a very large number, and in fact, we can do it this way. Okay, I wanted to go over, just mention something which I believe happened yesterday afternoon. That is, what happens when you are trying to calculate fluctuations and averages using the methods of statistical mechanics. Imagine that we have a minus beta times h, which is the form sum over r of some number hr times a variable sigma at r. Sigma is a random variable, h is a number, and then k times sigma at r times sigma at s. And this funny r comma s inside of these brackets is the usual meaning of let's look at r and s, which are nearest neighbors to each other. It doesn't matter much for what's on the rest of the slide exactly what's here. It doesn't matter much what the meaning of sigma is. It could be an Ising variable, as I believe you discussed yesterday afternoon, or it could be any other kind of variable, continuous variable. It could take on values 0, 3, and minus 4. It doesn't matter. In any one of those cases, the average value of sigma r is proportional to the derivative of the logarithm of the partition function with respect to hr. The partition function being defined as always as z is the sum over all possible values of all of the sigmas of e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian. Trace means let's sum over all possible values. This thing means all of the different sigmas. Define z in this fashion, and then it is true, as you learned, that the average value of sigma at r is the derivative of the logarithm of z with respect to hr, and that the combination average of sigma r, sigma s, minus the average of sigma r times the average of sigma s, which also can be written in this way as the fluctuations in sigma r from its average, fluctuations in sigma s from its average. This thing is going to be the second derivative of the logarithm, the partition function defined back there with respect to hr and hs. It is, of course, automatically symmetrical in R and S. Last collection of mathematical stuff before we go on to do more or less physics. The probability density in momentum P and space R. Here I'm going to work in three-dimensional space, so this so the Hamiltonian is px squared plus py squared plus pz squared divided by 2m plus a potential u of r, and r being a three-dimensional vector. The work of Maxwell and Boltzmann defined statistical mechanics by saying that this probability density is an exponential of minus a Hamiltonian divided by kt times some constant 1 over z. This, for example, holds if we're in a box of volume omega. So we describe such a box by setting u of r equal to infinity outside the box and 0 inside, and then we are holding our particle in the box. We can then calculate the partition function, first by doing partition function being the integral over three-dimensional R space, three-dimensional P space, e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian. We can calculate this first by doing the integral over R. That gives us the volume of the box. Then we do the integral over P. P is px times, this is dpx times dpy times dpz. That's what gave us the result in the last lecture, in which we had integral p squared dp. This is then the three-dimensional volume element of momentum times an exponential of minus beta p squared over 2m. This integral is easily done because it is a sum of different terms in px squared, py squared, and pz squared. And each one of those different terms is of Gaussian form. And then after a moment's calculation, you get this answer, omega times 2 pi m divided by beta. Beta is 1 over kt, all raised to the 3/2 power. Now, we can use this probability density to calculate the average of something. Imagine that something we wanted to calculate was some function of P and R, some function of the three-dimensional momentum and the three-dimensional position. Then you use the usual formula in which you sum over everything in sight. That's summing over everything in sight. The probability or probability density for that thing, that's rho of P of R, times the thing you want to calculate the average of, G of P and R. So this is then a standard everyday formula for calculating averages. You can also calculate sums. You can calculate the total amount of G by imagining that there are n particles in the system, and that n times d, and that each one of those particles is represented by such a term in the Hamiltonian. So now we're talking about n non-interacting particles. You then think about that by talking about not this probability distribution, but the multiplication of that probability distribution by n. If there are n particles in the system, n times dp d times dr times rho of p of r is the number of particles which have position and momentum within dp dr about the point in phase space p and r. The quantity n times rho of p of r, usually written as f of p and r, is called the distribution function. The total amount of some quantity given given by G is given in terms of the distribution function, as the total amount of G is the integral over P and R of the distribution function F of P of R times G of P of R. Rho answers the question, what's the probability? F answers the question of how much do we have. For example, we calculated the average energy, average of p squared over 2m, as 3 halves kt by using this integral over rho. But we could also calculate the total energy in the system, 3 halves n kt, by doing the integral over f of the distribution function. We're going to use the distribution for something function for something in a moment. So if you don't have it clear in your mind, please try to ask a question about what it is. Okay, now we're going to start on something which is not trivial, not just a definition. The normalization condition for probabilities is, of course, that the sum over all possibilities of the probability that that possibility will occur, that's like the average of 1, and the average of 1 is 1. The normalization for the distribution function is that the sum total of f of p and r is n. Let's talk now about the total, about the pressure for a moment. The pressure is defined as the total momentum transfer to a wall of unit area and let me do a wall and talk about what happens. Pressure is force per unit area on the wall. Here's a wall. Force occurs because particles come in and are reflected off the wall. If this direction is x, a particle might come in with a velocity vx, which is the same as px over m. The pressure P is defined as the total momentum transfer to a wall per unit of area. So this bit of wall that I have shown here has an area dA during the time dt. So I'm going to look at the wall during the time dt. The force is proportional, of course, to dA and dt. Since a low-density gas, and that's what we're going to be talking about because it's the simplest case, since the low-density gas is the same all over, the number hitting is the number within the distance px over m dt of the wall. That is, in the time dt, the number hitting is the number within the distance vx times dt, or px over m times dt, times the distribution function f of p and r. But this thing is supposed to be independent of r. Let's see what that says that here. This is the integral dp of f of p of r times px over m dt, proportional to dt, proportional to dA. there is only one more thing to be said, and that this is the integral, which covers only positive values of px. We're not thinking about particles moving away from the wall. We're thinking about particles moving towards the wall. So we have the integral dp, f of pr, px over m, dt over times dA, with the integral covering all p's with the condition that px is greater than 0. If the particle hits the wall and bounces back with the same momentum, that's called a specular reflection condition, then the total momentum transfer is twice as big as that. And there should be a 2 someplace in the next formula. There it is. The total momentum transferred is the integral over p, f of p and r, the size of the region that we're talking about, the size of the area that we're, the size of the region we're talking about is all of this, times the momentum transfer, 2 dpx. This is the transfer of momentum in the x direction, and that's what causes the pressure on the wall. Condition is px greater than 0. If we drop that condition, we should drop this factor of 2 if we want to integrate over all p's. That's okay, because the particles going this way have the same probability of according to the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution as the particles going that way. So we can drop this factor of 2 and say that the pressure is the integral dp of f of p and r times px squared over m. This way of approaching the pressure is called kinetic theory. And kinetic theory existed well before statistical mechanics and is a fundamental and useful way of calculating all kinds of things. If you go back and use the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution function and you calculate this integral using f is n times e to the minus beta h divided by z, you get out the number of particles times the Boltzmann constant times the temperature, as we knew the pressure should be in a good classical gas. It says here the partition function is the sum over all variables e to the minus beta h. We've said that a very large number of times. For a large n, this could be interpreted as w times e to the minus beta times the average value of h, where w is the number of configurations, the number of times you get out a given value of that energy. The w is the number of configurations which enter. Boltzmann argued that this number of configurations that enter is equal to the entropy divided by the Boltzmann constant, or rather that the logarithm of w is the entropy divided by the Boltzmann constant. This is an important connection between w, which is a quantity from statistical mechanics, or maybe kinetic theory, but really statistical mechanics, and s, which is a quantity from thermodynamics. Now we have some tying together of kinetic theory, which is how particles move around, statistical mechanics, which is basically e to the minus beta h, and thermodynamics, which, as you know, is basically about average energies and entropies and that kind of thing. This is mostly for the tutors. I have some suggestions for homework problems. Work out the value of the pressure for a classical, that is, not with Boltzmann statistics, but classical statistics, relativistic gas with Hamiltonian is equal to P times C. Do it by both using kinetic theory, as above, and also by differentiating the partition function. Many of you know how the how the derivative of the partition function is related to the pressure. If you don't, look it up. You can find a book. You can find it on Wikipedia. You don't need me to tell you that, although I will tell it to you several times in the course of these lectures. The other two questions which I was going to suggest is that for a Hamiltonian of the standard form, what you all might want to calculate the pressure and connect it to what you know about van der Waals formula. If you don't know much about van der Waals formula, you nonetheless can get out the pressure. And then this is finally something about random walks, which will come up in the next lecture. In any case, my suggestions to the tutors, who will then put together what they think is appropriate for a homework assignment, because that's their domain, not mine. Okay, so that's the end of this. And if I get my glasses on, I can, or even without my glasses on, I suspect, I can get to the next part of these lectures. Window. Have you ever given a lecture and then come to the point of opening up your computer so that you can get to the next part of the lecture, and out pops, of course, because that's what you're doing, some computer game in another, and the audience laughs and thinks it's very funny? Well, didn't happen this time, but it'll happen one of these times. Okay. Next part. This is all about what happens on lattices. Here's an outline. The outline mostly reflects, as I've said before, what I did last year, not necessarily what I did this year. However, one of the things that's going to happen on a lattice is I'm going to talk about the relationship between statistical mechanics and quantum mechanics. It therefore behooves me to tell you, remind you about quantum mechanics, even though you've seen now quantum mechanics many times in your life. This slide is supposed to tell you all that there is of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics starts out with a set of states which have this form. They appear as a bra and a ket, a la Dirac. Dirac invented this notation. If you have all the possible states, the sum over all possible states adds up to the unit operator. The trace of any operator in this space is given by the sum over all possible states in any representation of the diagonal elements of P. If you want to know the time dependences given by quantum mechanics, you say that an operator P, operators represent more or less observable quantities. An operator, the observable quantity at time T, is this observable quantity at time 0 times factors of e to the minus Hamiltonian times time, or e to the I h times the Hamiltonian times time on the other side. Hamiltonian is a function of the variables that represent perhaps position and momentum. To represent any function of any operator, perhaps e to the minus ht, you use the standard formulas. That is, this is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity of minus I h t raised to the power n divided by n factorial. If you can then define products of operators, you can equally well define any function of the operator. And the products of operators are defined by, I guess I didn't put that on the slide, p times q is the sum over all possible states n of p, n, n, Q. That's the definition of the product of P and Q. And then it gives a unambiguous meaning to this e to the minus iht. But you all knew that. The partition function, oh my gosh, I only needed this much to define quantum mechanics. Now it looks like I'm defining quantum statistical mechanics. The partition function z depends on 1 over kt. It is the trace. Now, the trace here means the quantum mechanical trace, this trace. It is the trace of t of e to the minus I beta, that is the trace of e to the minus beta times h. That's the same standard formula as we use in classical statistical mechanics. Nothing has changed but the meaning of the Hamiltonian. And then if you write this in terms of eigenvalues for the Hamiltonian, it's the exponential of minus beta times the eigenvalue alpha, epsilon sub alpha, summed over all alpha. If you want the average of any quantity q, you calculate the trace of t of minus I beta, that is e to the minus beta h, times q, and divide by this partition function. If you want the average of things at two different times, you define the things at two different times, and then take the trace of the guys at the two different times, times t of minus I beta, divided by the partition function. And then if you're using what is called the grand canonical ensemble, that is, if you're using a representation in which you're allowing to sum over all numbers of particles, the t is e to the minus I h minus mu n times t. So that's all you need to know about quantum mechanics, and indeed all you need to know about quantum statistical mechanics. All the rest are applications. Well, let me back off. Questions, comments? Please.
How is minus I beta the same thing as e to the minus beta?
Okay. We define t as e to the minus I times h times t. This is the operator t, which depends on the time. This operator, evaluated at time minus I beta, you stick for t minus I beta, and then you get enough minus signs so that you get t of minus I beta is e to the minus I ht, evaluated t equals minus I beta, and you stick in for t minus I beta and play games, and pretty soon you do your stuff, and it's e to the minus beta h. This is a deep fact, however. Now you got me turned on, I'll give my speech. This is a deep fact that the time development operator, this operator, T of T, is exactly the same as the operator that gives you the statistical weight, e to the minus beta h. The only thing is that you let this time be minus I beta. The deep fact, then, is that statistical mechanics is the same as quantum mechanics, sort of, with times going off in the imaginary direction. And we're going to do a lot of that. But before we do that, we're going to do a one-dimensional statistical mechanics on a lattice. So here's a lattice. A lattice is just a fancy mathematician's term for a regular set of points. Points are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to n. And the rather general kind of statistical mechanics problem with nearest neighbor interactions is that you define a partition function as an exponential of w, which depends on q1 and q2, that is, it depends on these two guys, plus a w that depends on these two guys, plus a w that depends on so forth and so on, until that you come to the end, and then you get a w which depends on these guys. These w's are of the form e to the minus beta times a Hamiltonian, which depends on these nearest neighbors, but I'm not going to write that Hamiltonian, because I'm saving the word Hamiltonian for something else that's going to come out later on. This particular choice of ending with a w that goes from there back to there gives us periodic boundary conditions and makes calculations easier. Now I'm going to convert this calculation from statistical mechanics, sums over all q's of this thing, into a calculation in quantum mechanics. I'm basically using a Feynman path integral formulation of what quantum mechanics is about, but all I really have to do is define a operator, T. It's not accidental that I use the same symbol for the operator as I used there. An operator T, which has a matrix element between states Q and P, which is exponential of W of Q and P. This is a definition. If I could find it on my computer, I would have the three lines there to show that this was a definition. It defines this matrix element of T. You substitute this expression into this expression for the partition function. We'll then have what's written on the next slide. What's written on the next slide is partition function is the sum over all q's of q matrix element of t between q1 and q2, between q2 and q3, between qn minus 1 and qn, and finally we have qn back to Q1. I want you to believe and see that nothing has happened. I have done nothing complicated. It's just defining stuff. Now, there's one more definition. This is the definition of matrix multiplication. And we use that. And this definition of matrix multiplication is given once more here. And now we see that the partition function is given as the matrix multiplication of T times T times T times T times T. And then finally, you get T to the n, and you're summing over Q1 of Q1, T to the n, Q1. And that's the definition of the trace. So the partition function is the one-dimensional partition function is the matrix element defined this way raised to the nth power and quantum mechanical trace. So now I'm going to define a Hamiltonian. Well, first I'm going to take a deep breath and let you ask questions or see what I've done or think about it or sip on your coffee or whatever. Okay. Imagine that T is an exponential of a Hamiltonian. I'm defining then by the Hamiltonian by T is the exponential of minus h times tau. I'm apparently defining tau times h. And then I have, this is a matrix element statement. The matrix element of T is the matrix element of the exponential of tau times h. In fact, this T is what we called before capital T of minus I tau. And what we're calculating then is the partition function of the trace of capital T of minus I tau to the nth power, and is the trace of e to the minus n tau h. And if h has eigenvalues epsilon sub alpha, it is the sum over all eigenvalues of exponential of n times tau times the energy of those eigenvalues. What you see here is that if you can calculate a one-dimensional nearest neighbor statistical mechanics problem, you can define a corresponding problem involving Hamiltonians, and you can calculate the trace of e to the minus tau times h for any tau, and from that you can learn anything you want about the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. And my hands have not disappeared up my sleeves in for 1 second. This is just the definition of Feynman's path integrals. Here comes Feynman. Feynman showed how to convert problems of quantum mechanics. I just followed Feynman's logic. Convert problems of quantum mechanics into a path integral, that is, a sum along a path. Here my path was from 0 to n. He did it as an integral. We put his path on a one-dimensional lattice. Every quantum mechanical trace can be converted into a one-dimensional statistical mechanics problem, and vice versa. More generally, d-dimensional quantum mechanics converts to d plus one-dimensional statistical mechanics. Here, what we did in the last slide was a zero-dimensional statistical mechanics quantum problem became a one-dimensional statistical mechanics problem. The basic idea about going up and back in this way is due to Feynman. I don't think Feynman ever quite said this, the guy who emphasized that statistical mechanics is the way to do quantum mechanics is Kenneth Wilson, and you'll hear more about him in this course. Many of you have seen path integrals before. I suspect that few of you have seen it exactly this way, but whatever I ask, I find lots of people who know lots of stuff, so I won't even ask. The simplest and most fundamental problem in quantum theory is a particle in a one-dimensional potential. H is p squared plus 2m plus u of q. All I've done here is changed r to q, where p and q obey the standard commutation relations with I h bar. However, I'm going to stick with units in which h bar equals 1, so you'll never see h bar, or hardly ever. In order then to talk about the standard problem, I might define a capital T, an operator, with matrix elements between position eigenstates q and q prime, which is an exponential of m q minus q prime squared over 2 tau plus tau times u of q. This tau times u of q is the familiar stuff. It is just this potential. You might guess, and it is true, that this thing is, in fact, the matrix element of p squared over 2m. In fact, that's what this thing, which might have been a homework problem, is that you show that this object, this exponential, is in fact the matrix element of this object, e to the minus tau p squared over 2m, between position eigenstates. I suspect I've already given too many homework problems, so maybe we won't give the tutors won't give that one. In any case, this is a way of defining the standard Hamiltonian problem in zero-dimensional Hamiltonian mechanics in terms of a one-dimensional statistical mechanics problem, you use this kind of matrix element. It's a little tricky because it's not clear whether this should be U of Q or U of Q prime or one half the sum of U of Q and U of Q prime. And because U, because the kinetic energy and the potential energy do not commute with each other, the definitions are a little tricky. I'm going to therefore stay away from this problem and deal with a simpler problem. But in any case, if we wish to know the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian, we would solve the statistical mechanics problem and then use this formula in order to get the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. This approach provides a powerful method for both numerical and analytical approach to quantum problems. However, I'll do a simpler case here. The simpler case which I'm going to do here involves a linear chain and Ising variables. I'm supposed to go to 11:50. Okay, so 30 minutes. The simpler case that I'm going to do here involves a linear chain and Ising variables. So here's our old friend position 1, position 2, 3, n. And I'm going to put on each one of these positions a variable sigma, which I can represent by plus 1 and minus 1, or by an up arrow or a down arrow. The W, defined at the beginning of this part of the lecture, is e to the k times the Ising variable on the site multiplied by the Ising variable on the nearest neighbor site, e to the k sigma sigma prime. And this we will think of as a matrix element of some quantum operator t between eigenstates sigma and sigma prime. What at this stage, it looks simple. However, it is also hard to get your mind around what this is about. And it isn't as simple as it looks. So here we have a linear chain. And you remember how one does variables which can take on two values in quantum mechanics. One uses what are called the Pauli spin matrices. There's a matrix 1, it's a unit matrix, which has 1s on the diagonal. There's a matrix called tau 1, which has 1s on the off diagonals. There's a matrix tau 3, which has a 1 and minus 1. And then a matrix tau 2, which has an I and a minus I. And I can never properly remember which one should be I and which one should be minus I. And going up and back between this notation and this notation, we have to think a little bit. One way of doing it is to say that an arbitrary matrix can be written in terms of matrix elements between eigenstates of tau 3 of the form, here's an eigenstate tau 3 is minus 1, here's an eigenstate of tau 3 is plus 1. An arbitrary thing can be written as in terms of a 2x2 matrix in which the matrix elements are that. I'm going to write the same thing again and again in various notations. And you will recognize that it is both simple and hard to get your mind around. The unit matrix is defined to be such that it is 1 on the diagonals, 1 when sigma equals sigma prime, and 0 when sigma is different from sigma prime. In another notation, that is delta sigma sigma prime. The delta symbol is equal to 1 when these two guys are equal, and equal to 0 when they're unequal. So this is a way of writing the unit matrix. Tau 1 is a matrix which is 1 when off diagonal and 0 on the diagonals. it is delta sigma minus sigma prime. It is only one when these two guys are different. Tau 2 and tau 3 are the result of multiplying these guys, respectively, by sigma. And so these guys by sigma and are defined here and here. I will use tau 2 and tau 3 hardly at all. Well, I'll make use of tau 3 because sigma represents an eigenvalue for tau 3. I won't use tau 2 at all. These matrices have a very direct physical meaning. The matrix tau 3 is diagonal in the sigma representation and represents the spin itself. Conversely, tau 1 has only off-diagonal elements and has the result of changing the value of sigma. Let me erase a little bit and write down what tau 1 does. You have probably all seen this in at least twice, once in your previous quantum mechanics course and once in the quantum mechanics course here. But tau 1 operating on an eigenstate of tau 3 labeled by sigma gives you the opposite eigenstate of tau 3. That's the definition of tau 1. And is equivalent to what is written there. So now my job is to write out e to the k sigma sigma prime in all of the different ways I can write it out. This is the matrix element of T. If sigma is equal to sigma prime, then the thing is e to the k. What, how do I make sure sigma is equal to sigma prime? I write 1 plus sigma sigma prime over 2. Sigma takes on the values plus and minus 1, as does sigma prime. When sigma is equal to sigma prime, this product, sigma sigma prime, is 1, and you get 1. When sigma is different from sigma prime, this product is minus 1, you get 0, and this term disappears. Conversely, this term is there when sigma is equal to minus sigma prime and not otherwise. That's why this and this are equal. If we rearrange terms here, the term e to the k plus e to the minus k times 1/2 in each case is the hyperbolic cosine of k, and sigma sigma prime from this rearrangement is the hyperbolic sine of k. We could also write this as the matrix elements of e to the k times 1, e to the minus k times tau 1, because of this and this. Nothing has happened. I have just defined and multiplied things which take on values plus or minus 1. Nonetheless, you should look at the notes and read and see what I said, because it's not trivially simple. So I mostly say this again. E to the k sigma sigma prime is sigma times this t, which I will come to, times sigma prime, which is this and this and this. This is just saying it again. And now I will define something new. Sorry about this. I forgot to erase one of the two times I wrote it down. It's exactly the same as was on the last slide. I'm going to define k naught tilde and k tilde by e to the k sigma sigma prime is the matrix element of e to the something or other, which is going to be my Hamiltonian. This is going to be my Hamiltonian. It is a number, something trivial, multiplying the unit operator, plus something, plus a number, multiplying the operator tau 1. That's going to give me this guy. T is, in fact, this. And this is simply a definition now of k naught tilde and k tilde. I can rewrite this because of this kind of expression. Sigma sigma prime take, whenever sigma sigma prime takes on the values plus and minus 1, e to the k sigma sigma prime is cosh k plus sigma sigma prime sinh k. I can rewrite this. I take the e to the k naught tilde, that's just a constant, out from outside, and then I get the matrix element of cosh k tilde plus sinh k tilde times tau 1. Now, we're going to work with k tilde. The quantity k tilde depends on k. Now I have have to complain to you. I do most of this, not exactly all of it. This was done in LaTeX, but all of this was done in Keynote. Keynote has no decent method, as far as I know, for putting a tilde on top of something. So I can't use this, which is sort of the standard notation for this quantity. Instead, I will write it as d of k. K tilde, of course, depends on k, since we started out with k. So I'll write k tilde as d of k. Why I use the symbol d will appear in after a while. Quantity k tilde depends on k. I write this this dependence as k tilde as d of k using the term in 1 and the term in tau 1, that is these two terms. I find that the hyperbolic, okay, let's do it. The ratio of this term to this term is the hyperbolic tangent of k tilde, or the hyperbolic tangent of d of k. The ratio of this term to this term, or rather of this term to this term, is e to the minus 2k, and is just exactly the same thing as that ratio. So what we have is that e to the minus 2k, that's the ratio of this guy to this guy, is exactly the same as the ratio of this guy to this guy, and is the hyperbolic tangent of k tilde, which is the hyperbolic tangent of d of k. And so we come out with the tangent, hyperbolic tangent of k is e to the minus k, or we solve for k, given k is minus the logarithm of the hyperbolic tangent of d of k over 2. Nothing has happened here but a tiny bit of algebra. The tiny bit of algebra is how we handle 2x2 things as matrices or as numbers. However, at risk of repeating myself, I will say that although this stuff is in some sense trivial, is in another sense hard to get your mind around. So we just learned this relationship, that the hyperbolic tangent of d of k is e to the minus 2k. Playing games with the functions is lots and lots of fun, but not entirely trivial. One of the best students from last year did a project which involved hypergeometric functions and impressed everyone. When I was a young physicist, I had lots of fun playing with Bessel functions and learning about them, and that was lots of fun too. This is only going to be dealing with exponential functions, nonetheless, it's not quite trivial. The hyperbolic tangent of d of k from here is e to the k, e to the minus k times 2. Twice e to the d of k minus e to the minus d of k. That's the, this thing is the hyperbolic sine of d of k, and we divide by the hyperbolic cosine of d of k. That's trivial. The 2's will cancel out. I'm going to cancel out this e to the d of k. I'm going to cancel out this e to the d of k and rewrite this as 1 plus 1 minus e to the minus 2 d of k divided by 1 plus e to the minus 2 d of k. And I'm going to notice that this function d of k depends on k as this thing is e to the minus 2k. Then I'm going to multiply through by this denominator and rearrange terms. When I end up doing that, I get the expression on line 3 there. 1 is e to the minus 2k times e to the minus 2 d of k plus the product of those two guys, e to the minus 2k times e to the minus 2 d of k. That harmless expression has one slightly less harmless result. This whole thing is symmetrical in d of k and k. So whatever the relationship is between d of k and k, there's exactly the same relationship between k and d of k. That is that going backwards is the same as going forwards. That's why d of k is called the dual. Dual is the d in d of k. It's called the dual of k because you have a simple relationship between going backwards and forwards. And if we apply d of k is, if we apply the trivial relationship, d of k is identical to d of k. In the, to going in the other direction, we then get k is d of k, or we get the functional inverse, d to the minus 1 of k is equal to d of k. That's what you mean by going backwards is the same as going forwards. Two applications of d takes you back to where you were before, or you have d to the minus 1 is equal to d. In any case, we have a value for this function. E to the minus 2k is that. And we can then plot the dual as a function of k. The plot looks like this. Whenever k is large, the dual is small. Whenever k is small, the dual is large. Now, you may think that I'm wasting my time doing this. This is a lot of sound and fury about almost nothing at all. It is indeed almost nothing, some of the properties of exponentials. However, in the most elegant kind of physics, models with a value of the coupling k are related to slightly different models with values of the coupling d of k. Depending on exactly what model you're talking about, D is one function or another function, but they always obey this relation. In particular, in the fanciest forms of string theory and of the M theory, we have relations between models and their duals. Those relations always involve taking us from a situation where we have a coupling which, when one coupling is strong, the dual coupling is weak. And when the coupling is weak, the dual coupling is strong. That means that when we can, in general, solve problems when couplings are weak, do perturbation theory. That means if we solve a problem when the coupling is weak, we have solved the dual problem when the coupling is strong. And that's a very important advance that occurs in lots and lots of physics. In any case, we are going to analyze the behavior of this one-dimensional Ising chain and then of the two-dimensional Ising model in terms of both the coupling K and the dual coupling K tilde, which are related in the form of this exponential relation. We will see that there are interesting things to say about the dual coupling. So now the first thing we're going to do is solve the one-dimensional Ising model. There's a story that goes with this. I'll tell the story, and then we'll just have time, I think, to look at the solution. Once upon a time, there was a big-shot physicist by the name of Lenz. Once upon a time was in 1923, if I remember correctly. And he had a little-shot student by the name of Ising. Ising, almost everybody has heard of Ising now, and practically nobody has heard of Lenz, but that's another story entirely. Ising was given a problem by Lenz. That problem was to solve this one-dimensional Ising model. It wasn't called the Ising model at the time, I assure you. If it was called anything, it was called the Lenz model, but it wasn't much called anything because those guys had just invented it. In fact, what they were looking for was a phase transition, a change into a ferromagnetic behavior for this one-dimensional model. Ising was successful in that he solved the one-dimensional model and showed clearly and unambiguously by his solution that there was no phase transition in the one-dimensional Ising model. In fact, we know now the one-dimensional models essentially never have phase transitions. So both Lenz and Ising were very, very disappointed. However, in further years, lots of people worked on models of this kind in higher dimensions, and it became a very fashionable thing to do. And as they did it, they called it after Mr. Ising. Mr. Ising moved from Germany to my home state of Illinois and had a further career teaching high school in my home state of Illinois. It was sort of never heard of again in fancy physics. But his model lives on, and his name is used in contexts like this hundreds of times a day. In any case, the solution is that we have the partition function for the Ising model is the product of n terms like this T. And T is e to the k times the unit matrix times e to the minus k times tau 1, all this raised to the nth power. And tau 1 has eigenvalues 1 and minus 1. When tau 1 is 1, this thing is e to the k plus e to the minus k, which is twice the hyperbolic cosine of k. When tau 1 is minus 1, this is e to the k plus e to the minus k, which is twice the hyperbolic sine of k. A trace is a sum over all the eigenvalues of what is inside of it. And so here's the value of the partition function. What these guys were looking for was a change in behavior at a ferromagnetic phase transition, and this has no change in behavior. It just goes on and goes from smoothly through as you go from k is minus infinity to infinity. For n, the number of sites being very large, which is the usual situation that you think about in statistical mechanics, the partition function is twice the hyperbolic cosine of k raised to the nth power. This doesn't count for anything. The free energy, which is the logarithm of z, free energy divided by kt, minus sign, which is the logarithm of z, is n times the logarithm of the hyperbolic cosine, and nothing whatsoever interesting happens to this free energy or this hyperbolic cosine. Nonetheless, this is an important beginning. This important beginning partially is a way of calculating things for chains, which I will talk about a little bit now and a little bit next time, and partially gives us a start for working on higher dimensional problems, and those higher dimensional problems have much more interesting behavior. So, the partition function is the trace over all of these q's of the exponential of w of q1, q2. And this becomes the trace, in a quantum mechanical sense, of e to the minus n times the quantum mechanical operator h, which is the exponential of n times the energy of the you get the sum of energies of the different eigenstates, but the only thing that counts in the large n limit is the smallest eigenvalue of h, and so you get n times the smallest eigenvalue of h. Now we want to think about what happens when we want to calculate the average value of x, for x being any operator. So we use the formula of the trace of exponential of w of q times x. That trace is going to be the average of x. And in the limit of large n, that is going to be the ground state, average in the lowest state of x. In this way, we can use statistical mechanics to calculate the average of any operator in the ground state of any quantum mechanical system. That's what we get by taking n to infinity. If we don't take n to infinity, we can do the corresponding calculation to calculate the average of any operator in a sum of eigenstates, the sum being defined by a so-called canonical distribution, e to the minus beta h. We can even calculate time correlation functions. And in fact, this is what I'm going to do in the next slide, and in fact pick up in the next lecture, I think. So we're going to calculate the partition function, which is e to the trace of the exponential of k times the product of nearest neighbor sigmas. We've in fact done that. It's the hyperbolic cosine raised to the nth power plus the hyperbolic sine raised to the nth power. We can calculate the average value of sigma. Well, I can actually do that in my head because the problem has a symmetry between positive sigma and negative sigma. The average value of any sigma k is zero, so that we'll do that calculation, but it's no big deal. We can then calculate the product of two sigmas, the correlation between two values of sigma at different points in the chain. That is a big deal, and that is something we can learn a lot from. And that's what we're going to do next time. But we have come exactly to the hour and 15 minutes, and this is a good place to break away. and to start thinking about questions and answers or lunchtime. Questions, comments? Aside from a little bit of rewriting, it's all in the notes which you have, in, probably in written form. Yes, you have them in written form. You can find them on the web. As far as I know, there are no significant errors in the notes. I did a little bit more clearly here, but not much more clearly. And you can, you should go over it. It is, in a first reading, it looks like easy stuff, but it's not. So, lunchtime. Thank you.
So this report starts at 1:30.